Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, construction is underway on the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge project. We'll find out what commuters need to know.
Stay away. If you don't need to be here, don't come anywhere near the area.
Also today, controversy at the ICA. Can a white artist depict black pain, or is that just racial appropriation? And should cultural institutions support such art?
I believe that this piece is an injustice to the black community. I believe that it really doesn't do anything for the black experience, and I feel that this piece is actually a mockery.
Plus, two opposing views on the upcoming release of one of the most notorious figures in the clergy sex abuse scandal. And the MBTA is going cashless by 2020. Could digital payments on the T speed up the cashless revolution elsewhere in our lives? That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Stay away. If you don't need to be here, don't come anywhere near the area.
That's Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack earlier this week. And every week I end up having one favorite piece of sound. And guys, this is it this week. So can we play that again?
Stay away. If you don't need to be here, don't come anywhere near the area.
Now, Secretary Pollack, I so wish we could comply with your request, but sorry, we here at WBUR cannot. Because what you're talking about, she's talking about a giant stretch of Commonwealth Avenue and multiple lanes on the Mass Pike. They are getting shut down today. And full disclosure, WBUR studios are right in the middle of it on Comm Ave. We can see all this construction and the ensuing chaos that it is going to be causing. Now, this is all in an attempt to repair a critical Commonwealth Avenue bridge that spans the Mass Pike. And construction is slated to last until August 14th, which of course means a whole lot of disruption and traffic headaches for tens of thousands of commuters and drivers who are going to have to navigate around Boston and the Charles River without this critical east-west passage for a while. So again, we're right here on Comm Ave. We can hear the rumbling of the construction equipment, and we can also hear the complaining already. So stay calm, everyone. We have an update. Joining us now is Jonathan Gulliver. He's acting Massachusetts Highway Administrator. Mr. Gulliver, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on.
Are you hearing complaints already, too?
We have not been hearing a lot of complaints, which is good. Nothing more than expected. And, you know, I'll echo the Secretary's sentiments here, is that if you can stay away from this area, that's really the best thing to do. And so far, we have not seen any major traffic impacts, and that's because we haven't done any of our major reductions yet. At this point, only the Green Line is impacted. But starting tonight, and then especially going into this weekend, Comm Ave Bridge tonight is going to be started to see some serious impacts on local traffic. And then starting coming into this weekend is when the Pike is going to start to be impacted.
Right. I mean, I'm glad you're not hearing complaints yet, but I never underestimate the power of the Boston commuter to complain preemptively. But I'm trying to have a little bit of fun here because it is going to cause major disruption. There's over a mile of Commonwealth Avenue that's closing down, reducing the Pike to two lanes in each way. So that's going to mean that east-west travel in major areas of greater Boston is going to be tough. I mean, can Memorial Drive, can Storrow Drive, can Route 2, can the alternative routes handle the increased traffic you're likely to see?
So they can handle it. However, there's absolutely going to be congestion as a result of this. All of these roadways are designed for a certain level of service, and as you know, there's only so many ways in and out of the city. So if nobody diverts, it could be really pretty tough on the average everyday commuter. So we're expecting some people to divert and take alternate routes, and especially if they can take the commuter rail in. The commuter rail is going to be available Monday through Friday. The pain that the average commuter is going to experience is not going to be as bad as it could be.
Mm. Well, what about on Commonwealth Avenue? I'm saying it's getting shut down, but there still will be buses, right, and pedestrian and bicycle traffic.
Right, that's correct. So Starting tonight at 7 p.m., the eastbound side of Commonwealth Avenue is going to be shut down to traffic. However, as you said, it will still be open for MBTA buses and also to emergency vehicles. And pedestrian bicyclists are going to be allowed full access during construction, although the expectation is that if you're taking that route as a pedestrian or a bicyclist, you may have to have your crossings at different points, and you can certainly expect that at one point or another you may be held up while certain construction operations are taking place. And by held up, I mean not delayed indefinitely, but maybe held up for 5 to 10 minutes as you're making your way through that work zone.
Yeah, so that's up above on Commonwealth Avenue, but also,
correct,
you know, we can't forget that the Mass Pike is going to be choked down to a couple of lanes on either side. But remind us, Jonathan Gulliver, like, why is this work having to be done? I mean, it's rather important. That ComAv bridge is not in great shape.
No, so the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge is what we call a structurally deficient bridge, and that means that it's nearing the end of its lifespan, and the amount of repairs that would take to keep it in a safe condition indefinitely far exceeds the amount that it's going to take us to actually just replace it. So this is a project that we identified several years ago as needing a replacement, and we've been working very hard for the last 5 years on the design and on the planning to get to this point to get where we are and get this thing replaced and get a brand new bridge with long-term 75-year lifespan and also with improved pedestrian, bicycle, and vehicular traffic above it.
Yeah, but only half the work's going to be done right now, right? Like, you're going to do it all over again next summer.
That's correct. This is a bridge that's complicated by really where it's located. It has a lot of different modes of travel on it. And in order to do this type of a project without completely disrupting it more than we are, we've broken it into two stages. So this year we're doing the slightly more complicated stage, which is removing the eastbound side of the bridge. I'm sorry, the westbound side of the bridge, along with the Green Line reservation. Next year it'll be the opposite side. So you can expect that next year we're going to have a similar kind of restrictions in place.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is part of the Accelerated Bridge Construction Program, as mentioned. Have you done work like this in an area of Greater Boston as sort of with as many complex transportation needs or as busy as this before?
We've done a lot of complicated projects in and around Boston. We've done them successfully, but certainly none that have this many complications. Again, we want to stress this is impacting all modes of travel, whether you're a bicyclist or a pedestrian or somebody driving through the site, either on top of the bridge or underneath the bridge, or if you're taking the Green Line or the commuter rail, you're going to be impacted in some way, shape, or form.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, so it is a very difficult project. And, you know, honestly, there's a lot of folks working on the bridge that share your pain, myself included, and the secretary both have to come through that area every day to get into our jobs, too. So there's a lot of eyeballs watching this project to make sure that it goes right.
Oh, we will be watching because we can literally see it from our studios. Like, I just look out the window from the office and we see the bridge. So,
yep.
I mean, I'll be perfectly honest. People around here are kind of freaking out. But is it safe to say that it's better to freak out for, I don't know, 14, 16, 18 days rather than the months, years possibly that this project could take if you did it on a more leisurely timeline?
Absolutely. And to look at it, if we had done this at traditional construction techniques, which is you demolish it piece by piece and do what we call stage construction, you would have not just restrictions, but you would have a series of shutdowns at various stages throughout the project. So we're doing this in 18 and a half days for the full length of the shutdowns. At Pike impacts, much less than that. That's down to, I believe, 14 days total. However, when you look at it from a standpoint of a rip the Band-Aid off approach versus the long-term type of stage construction, this is what, when we really looked at things, this was a far more desirable way of doing it. So we know it's going to be a tough couple of weeks, but the nice thing is that we'll be out of there and you'll be returning back to your normal traffic flow after that. And then again, a really quick hit again next year to do the
same
thing.
Well, and if it doesn't go according to plan, we will call you because we can see it. Okay.
No, I'm sure you will. And we expect everything to go to plan, and it's gone well so far. And again, a lot of time in planning and engineering has gone into getting to this point. So we have looked at every possible contingency plan at this point, and we feel really good about where we are.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. Jonathan Gulliver, Acting Massachusetts Highway Administrator, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
All right, let's stick to the subject of transportation here for a couple more minutes and talk more about public transit, because as you may have heard, the MBTA plans to go cashless by the year 2020. You'll need an app on your phone or use a Charlie card or a tappable credit card to ride when the new digital payment systems arrive. And for those of you not using things such as, say, Apple Pay, this could be the gateway to a cashless society, according to Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the Boston Globe, and he joins us now. Hello, Hiawatha.
Hi there. How you doing?
Good. I don't know. Do you have to drive to get to work? Is this common?
No. In case you hadn't heard, the Boston Globe has moved to an exciting new location in the heart of downtown Boston.
I had heard.
Yes, and I take the subway.
Okay, good. So you're not going to be
absolutely.
So you're not going to feel our pain here that we're having here at WBUR.
Not in the least. I'm going to sit back and watch with pleasure as you suffer.
So you're taking the subway now, which is why all of a sudden all of these people at the Boston Globe are really interested in public transit. Hooray!
You notice that?
Oh, it's shameful. There's a lot more tea articles in the paper.
Absolutely. Now it's news. Yeah.
Sorry, I could not help myself on that. But let's talk about.
No, you're right. You're not lying.
So let's talk about a cashless MBTA by the year 2020. Why are you so confident mm-hmm. that this could usher an era of a cashless society for those people who haven't switched over yet?
Well, it won't cause a cashless society by itself, but we have seen something like that happen in Britain. Starting in 2012, they stopped allowing people to use cash on buses, and they started moving to a number of alternatives. They didn't have Apple Pay yet, but what they were also introducing was something that actually it's not a new invention, but it's almost non-existent in America, contactless credit cards. They're called Wave and Go or Tap and Go credit cards. This is a credit card where you just walk up to the terminal and you just tap it. And you can instantly pay for anything. No PIN, no nothing. There's a limit of usually around 20 or 30 bucks. So if somebody steals it, there's a limit to how much they can spend. But these have become popular all over the world. And this is one of the reasons why. Hardly anybody used them in Britain, even though they were available, in 2012. Then they become a standard feature for getting onto the subway. And suddenly, people start using them. Today, in Britain, one out of every five credit card payment is used this way. You take out the card, you just tap it, and you go. It's become a standard way of doing things. And people use these, of course, to make small purchases, the kind of thing they used to once use cash for. Instead, now they're whipping out a card, they're tapping it, and they're going. I think that when you put this in public transport and people do it every single day, they start using these things. And that's going to push us a little bit further toward a cashless world.
Now, how is this different from the Charlie card system we've got here?
Well, it isn't hugely different, except you can use this card for everything else, too. That's what I'm getting at.
I see.
With a Charlie card, you have to charge it up. For example, we at the Globe have a thing where we automatically get a monthly pass every month. It's just taken out of our paychecks. But most people have to go to a vending machine, which is usually located in a T station, to charge it up. And that has caused all kinds of problems. I give you an example in the story. 7% of the people who ride buses in this town still pay cash. The buses still take money. And what they do is they get on the bus and they use the bus to charge their card. They put $10 on their card while everybody is standing behind them waiting to get on the bus. If you had tappable credit cards, you wouldn't have to do that. If you had Apple Pay, you wouldn't have to do that. And that's what this is a move toward. It's supposed to make the entire transit system move a lot faster.
I have been in those lines before, and I'm the one who had to like slide in the cash in the machine and then press the white button and then put my card on and then press the white button again and then tap again. And yes.
And it's all your fault.
And inevitably now, it's raining, so people get even more angry.
Yep. The T knows that people are going to keep using cash. They're going to put more vending machines in places all over the city so you won't have to go to a red line or a blue line terminal to charge up your card. There are going to be lots more places to do it. But they also hope that people will start using these tappable credit cards. The flip side is the banks are going to have to start issuing them.
Right.
And they haven't up to now because there's been no place to use them.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, suddenly, there's a reason for banks to issue these cards. And they cost maybe a little bit more than standard credit cards, but we are expecting to see that happen because the same terminals that are now letting people do things like Apple Pay when they go to the store, most of those terminals also take tappable credit cards. So the banks now have an incentive to start issuing those cards. And so little by little, we're going to start moving to a world where even if you're buying something for just a dollar or two, you're just going to walk up and do what they do in Britain and Australia and many other countries. Take out your card, just go tap. There you go. Well, there's your $1 purchase.
But isn't there always going to be a not insubstantial minimum of people who want to use cash for these small purposes? And so, I mean, one's saying cash is going to go away here.
Oh, nobody thinks cash is going to completely go away. And yes, there are going to be people who are going to use cash for those purposes. But little by little, I think that's going to dwindle. I wonder if the $1 bill is going to head in the direction of the penny. I don't know. As long as there are homeless people, that's nothing to worry about. Because when you walk through downtown Boston, you're handing out $1 bills all the time. But no, cashlessness is not going to be total. But we're going to get to the point where I know I go through an entire week where I will have like $20 in my pocket and never touch it because everything I encounter, I can do with plastic or I can do with my iPhone. And I think you're going to see more and more people living that way once they are given a good reason. And this move in public transportation is a good reason.
Well, so users might adopt it. Riders might adopt it. But when it comes to the other end of things, you already talked about sort of the what's inhibiting banks from doing it. But what about smaller shops? So, I mean, you point out that Apple Pay hasn't really taken off as much as it might have because, mom and pop stores have to buy the hardware to receive the Apple payments. And that's kind of an inhibitor.
Yeah, it is. And that's a fair point. It is going to inhibit the speed with which this is spreading. The last figure I saw said that only about 36% of American merchants are now fully Apple Pay compatible. That's a fair point. And that's going to slow this down because if you have a small retail store, you may not be able to spend the kind of money that it's going to take for you to transition. But, I mean, these things, as with all electronic devices, they are going to get cheaper.
Yeah.
And plus, there's the fact that, I don't know, many people haven't used them yet.
Right.
But one of the advantages of something like an Apple Pay, have you used those credit card readers where you have to shove it in with the chip and
wait
for
every
it
day.
To complete the...
All the time.
Apple Pay is it's much faster. It's almost as fast as swiping. And that's why I actually use it, because I don't have to sit around waiting for it to read the chip. I just take it, put my phone on it, bing, it works.
Honestly, Hiawatha, for me, we're talking about a difference of like 30 seconds. It's not going to, it doesn't end my life to have to wait this additional 30 seconds
for
the card.
But a lot of people, including me, find it frustrating, and I've got a device in my pocket so I don't have to do it. Why should I do it?
I'm running over time here, but there's one more thing I want to ask you. And that one of the reasons why I will never fully let go of cash, I don't want people tracking all my purchases all the time and where I go, what I do. I mean, like, inevitably, someone's going to take that cashless transaction information and sell it to somebody else. And, well, I guess I talk about it on the air, so it's not secret.
No.
And they'll find out, like, how many dozens of hot chocolates I buy every month.
You're absolutely right, and I don't disagree with you. I don't want to live in a totally cashless society either, because there are times I would like to have some privacy in what I'm doing with money. I agree with you. I don't want it to be completely cashless. I think we're going to get pretty close, though, because it's so convenient, it's almost irresistible. There are things where I have the cash, and I just say, what the heck, I'll use my Apple Pay. So I do that all the time.
The convenience versus privacy conundrum never ends.
There you go.
Hiawatha
Bray. Coming and going.
Tech writer for the Boston Globe. He joins us regularly on Radio Boston to talk tech. We've got a link to his latest column at radioboston.org. Hiawatha, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. As early as tomorrow, one of the most notorious figures in the clergy sex abuse scandal could be released from prison. Paul Shanley has spent the last 12 years in prison for raping a Sunday school student in the early 1980s. He was also accused of sexually abusing roughly two dozen other people over several decades. Now, we'll hear from an attorney for some of Shanley's alleged victims in a few moments. They do not want to see him released. But first, a defense attorney who specializes in defending accused sex offenders, Eric Tenen. Eric Tenen, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Mr. Tennant, I just want to get, first of all, right to the heart of why so many people, especially abuse survivors, are concerned about Shanley's release. I mean, just to remind folks, he did abuse about 24 children over the course of decades and went to prison for raping a Sunday school student. And there are ongoing concerns, and I'd like to play a little bit of tape here. This is Rodney Ford. His son Greg was allegedly molested by Shanley in the 1990s. And here's why he doesn't want to see Shanley released. And just a warning to listeners, there is some sexually explicit language in this tape.
He brutally raped, sodomized children. You can't tell me Paul Shanley doesn't fit the criteria of a sexually dangerous person. I can't agree with that.
Mr. Tennant, that gets right to the heart of people's concerns. I mean, what is there to prevent Paul Shanley from reoffending if he is released?
So when we're talking about sexually dangerous person, we're actually talking about a legal creation by the legislature that has a very specific definition. And I understand the emotion and sort of validate the emotion that comes from being a victim of abuse and what that must mean to the person. But when we're talking about publicly whether someone's a sexually dangerous person, it's a different – we're looking at something different. We're looking at whether someone is likely to – commit another act upon release, and there's lots of things that go into that calculus.
Well, so give me some of the parts of that calculus.
Sure. So there's actually a lot of research that talks about what sort of characteristics are correlated with reoffending, and Shanley really doesn't hit any of them. He's very old, and age is a robustly studied factor, and we know the older you are, the much less likely you are to reoffend across the board for any kind of crime, and especially sexual crimes. And that decrease starts happening in the 50s and 60s, and Shanley's now 86 years old. He's going to be supervised by probation. He's going to be registered. He has medical problems. So there's a whole host of things that what we call sort of mitigate his risk to reoffend. Mm.
But he's not going to be wearing any kind of ankle or bracelet or tracking bracelet, right?
I don't believe he is, no.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, I think I get your point. There's sort of a legal and medical criteria here, but people are seeking guarantees, right? I mean, like, how can we be sure, how can we guarantee that Shanley falls into that percentage of folks who aren't going to reoffend?
There's no guarantees ever on any side of this. We are talking about predictions of the future, which we can only do so good in terms of predicting. So what we do is we look at what we know and we try and apply that. And based on the characteristics at play here, it doesn't fit.
Do you think that the terms that you described earlier about, you know, serving probation, having to meet with a probation officer, et cetera, that is adequate to monitor someone like Paul Shanley to be sure that, you know, even when he's out, that he doesn't go down the path of reoffending?
It's more than adequate to monitor just about every person released with these kinds of charges, regardless of any other characteristic. It's a very small percentage of sex offenders that reoffend, despite public perception about that. And this, is, again, is based on research that tracks them for years, and this has been replicated in study after study. So we know most persons don't reoffend regardless. When you add to that some of these other mitigating factors specifically to Shanley, it gives even more confidence that it won't be an issue for him.
Mm. Now, forgive me for keeping on coming back to this,
sure.
but I'm thinking of how survivors, you know, may be responding to what you're saying, and I imagine a lot of them would say, "But I cannot risk my child or children that I know to what a study might say."
Sure. I mean, the problem is that these discussions are so often surrounded by emotion and very real, sincere emotion, but emotion doesn't always lead to sort of rational policy. You know, it's very difficult to explain someone who's emotionally involved in this case or in any case of this kind why I'm saying the things I'm saying. That's very difficult to do, but we as sort of a public have to understand that we approach these policies with more rationality, not, you know, driven by this emotion that, again, is very real, but is not a good way to base these policies.
Mm. I mean, do you think the system worked in this case, or is there a way, are there things that we can do, things that we can change to better satisfy all parties in cases like this?
So it's hard for me to sort of speak about what we can do to satisfy the victims in any of these cases and the emotional trauma that they suffer from it. That's, again, a very real thing, and I don't think there's anything that can be done on the criminal side or even on the civil commitment side that will ever satisfy that. We have to recognize that we're talking about different things. So when when it comes to Shanley or anyone like that, anyone who's being released from incarceration from a sexual offense, the question we're asking is, as a legal matter, is this person what we consider sexually dangerous? And if they don't meet that criteria, then they're released, and in theory, they're not meeting that criteria because they don't pose a danger to the public. That is different than making victims of any of these crimes feel somehow better about someone's release. I don't think you're ever going to reconcile that.
Mm. Let me just ask you this question sort of in a different way, perhaps a simpler way. What is justice in a case like this?
There is no simple answer to that. There are some, like myself, who believe that if you have a criminal case and you have a criminal conviction, sentencing is the time to deal with all these issues, to deal with how much should someone be punished, how much should we incarcerate someone to incapacitate them, how much should we incarcerate someone to rehabilitate them. All those things should be taken into account, and in theory, you're going to get to a sentence that deals with all that. Justice doesn't always look the same to everybody, and certainly when you have opposing views, people are going to think that justice wasn't served for them. That happens in all kinds of criminal cases, not just sexual offenses. And in this case, in theory, that was all taken care of at sentencing. That was all considered at sentencing. At this stage, it's a different question. It's not about justice. It's about whether there's a public safety risk in releasing someone, you know, who's just finished serving a sentence on a sexual offense, and he does not meet the criteria, nor do most of the people released from these kinds of sentences.
Well, Eric Tenen is a criminal defense attorney. Mr. Tenen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate you talking about these issues.
Let's turn now to Mitchell Garabedian. He represented several of Paul Shanley's alleged victims, as well as dozens of other victims of clergy sexual abuse. Mitchell Garabedian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, give us your response to what you heard Eric Tenen says. I mean, he says that two doctors, as we know, don't believe that Paul Shanley is going to pose a threat, and so there's no real evidence to civilly detain him.
Oh, the evidence is clear and convincing. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. I have represented many victims of Paul Shanley, along with other attorneys who've represented victims of Paul Shanley, and these victims were abused repeatedly over the course of decades upon decades. We're talking about dozens upon dozens of victims who were sexually abused by Paul Shanley. One of the criteria used by the doctors was that he hasn't sexually abused in years. Well, he's been in jail for 12 years. How could he sexually abuse a child while he's in jail? The doctors, I don't believe, took into consideration, for instance, that Paul Shanley was in the Institute of Living in Hartford in the 1990s for treatment. And now that's a well-known treatment center for pedophilia. There are many factors here that have to be taken into consideration that I don't believe were taken into consideration. I mean, we're talking about prevention here, prevention of child abuse, not cure. And I think it's very important that that be noted.
Well, so then, I mean, are you, Mitchell, if I may ask, are you really arguing that after the 12 years of Shanley's incarceration and nobody's doubting the guilt for the crimes that he was sentenced to, but that he is exactly the same today as when he committed those crimes? I mean, he's 86 years old now.
Yeah, you're right. He may be worse because he never admitted that he needed treatment while in prison. He never admitted being a sexual offender. He hasn't even dealt with the issue. Where is he going to be when he's released? No one seems to know. He has to report to a police station to give us his address, so his address will be public. But no one knows where he's going to be. How are children supposed to be protected? There's no proper supervision of Father Paul Shanley. He's not going to be wearing an ankle bracelet. He's not going to be wearing an electronic device, and he's up to his own with regard to meeting children and enticing children. He's very cunning. He's very clever. He's extremely manipulative. Mm. He knows exactly what he's doing.
But he will be under 10 years of supervised probation. I mean, there will be more points of contact than just that one, like reporting of his address. I mean, what more would you like to see in order to guarantee the prevention that you were talking about earlier?
Well, he has to be, first of all, he has to have an electronic device in terms of where his location is. Just because he's supervised doesn't mean he's going to be supervised on a daily basis or a weekly basis or even a monthly basis. He could call in. He could visit his probation officer and lie. He could say everything's fine, and when it isn't fine. Mm-hmm. He could have abused dozens of children and reported to probation and said, well, okay, I'm just going on with my life here. Everything's fine. And I also heard the fact of age. The fact that he's 86 years old doesn't persuade me in the least that he won't reoffend. Father John J. Gagin was in a retirement home in Regina Clary over here in Boston, a Catholic retirement home, when he sexually abused one of my clients. I represented thousands of clergy sexual abuse victims, thousands. And age is not a factor when it comes to them sexually abusing children, because it's so much about control as opposed to just sex. Mm. They have to be in control mentally. That's what it's about. So the factor of age does not come into play with regard to the ability to abuse or not abuse.
Michelle Garabedian, okay. One more question here for you, because I'm listening carefully to what you're saying, and it sounds like, if I dig deeper here, that, I mean, is the only satisfactory solution in your mind that people like Paul Shanley get locked away forever? Because that's, I mean, that wasn't the sentence that he received when he was found guilty of those terrible crimes. And I mean, and how can that be an appropriate sentence?
Well, maybe, well, he should be then treated for his pedophilia. He should be treated for his pedophilia. He should be civilly committed. Because that's the sentence that he should be serving, to keep children safe. The damage to a child is too great. The damage to a child's family is too great. The damage to a child's friends are too great when a pedophile strikes and then you try to cure the problem. He has to be treated as a pedophile. We're not dealing with a person who just, by the way, happened to abuse someone, which is terrible in and of itself, and I'm not trying to give any excuses, but this is a man who has a history of sexually abusing dozens of children over decades and decades. And now he's not even going to be supervised properly.
Mitchell Garabedian, I'm so sorry that I have to cut you off there, but I'm just flat out of time. But Mitchell Garabedian represented several of Paul Shanley's alleged victims and also multiple victims of clergy sex abuse. Mitchell Garabedian, it's always really great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1955, 14-year-old Emmett Till was brutally murdered by two white men in Mississippi for supposedly offending a white woman. The child was beaten, tortured, and drowned. Till's mother, Mamie, brought her son home to Chicago, and she insisted upon an open casket at his funeral. A photograph of Emmett's body, published in Jet magazine, to this day remains one of the most searing, undeniable images of white violence on black Americans. "Let the people see what I've seen," Mamie Till said. She wanted the world to see what those men had done to her son. Well, Emmett Till would have turned 76 just 2 days ago. His birthday was July 25th. And these many years later, racism, it still must be confronted. That is all our duties. But what happens when a white artist tries to do that confrontation by painting an image of Emmett Till? Is that empathy or is it appropriation? And should modern day art institutions support such artists? Well, those are some of the intense questions swirling about a new exhibition which opened just yesterday at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston. It features the work of abstract painter Dana Schutz. In 2016, Schutz painted an abstracted image of Till in a work titled Open Casket. That painting was put on display at the Whitney Museum in New York. It was immediately controversial. Protesters demanded that the painting be removed and even destroyed. Now, I should note, Open Casket, the painting, is not part of the ICA's exhibit of Schutz's work. But in an open letter to the ICA's chief curator, a group of local artists is saying that exhibiting any of Schutz's work is, quote, in line with a long tradition of white supremacy obscuring and ultimately erasing narratives of the continued genocide of black and indigenous peoples. Please pull the show, they write. This is not about censorship. This is about institutional accountability. So there is a lot there, and we want to discuss it because it centers on some very big questions about race, culture, and major cultural institutions here in Boston. And joining us to have this conversation is Ava Respini. She's chief curator at the Institute of Contemporary Art. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us is Barbara Lewis. She's director of the William Monroe Trotter Institute for the Study of Black History and Culture at UMass Boston, and she's one of the writers and signatories of that open letter to the ICA. Professor Lewis, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. And with us as well in the studio is Stephen Locke. He's a visual artist and an associate professor of art education at the Mass College of Art and Design. Professor Locke, welcome to you.
Magna, it's nice to be with you.
Barbara Lewis, may I just first start with you and just give me a sense, in a nutshell if you could, about what your concerns are, your major concerns are about the ICA having an exhibit of Dana Schutz's work.
Well, the ICA, as I understand it, started thinking about this exhibit 2 years ago, and so it was certainly aware of the controversy that erupted at the Whitney. But it seems to have paid little attention to that controversy and also to the context of racism here in Boston, which is very strong. It did not consult, as I understand it, with any of the artists who are black here in the city. It first had wind that there might be a whiff of danger and difficulty when it heard from white artists, and also reached out to white artists to find out what they might do. Hmm. It seems as though black artists were dead in this question.
Dead in this question. But yes. Okay, so but help me understand here a little bit, and then, Ava, I'm going to turn to you in a moment, but why is pulling the exhibit in its entirety, in your view, the best option here? Because, immediately, in your letter, you confront
okay,
this.
Wait a minute. I did sign the letter, but that does not mean that I agree with every scintilla of the letter. Also, the letter was written and sent before the show opened, so there was time for the ICA to make that decision. At this point, the show is already opened, so one of those animals, the horse or the cow or something, is out of the barn at this point. So pulling the show is no longer an option.
Ava Respini, respond here. There's a lot to dig into, but what is the ICA's position right now on showing Dana Schutz's work?
Indeed, there is a lot to respond to, and these issues are very complex. And there's a lot of opinions and voices that we have considered and are continuing to consider in our conversations on presenting Dana Schutz. When we started speaking with Dana about 2 years ago and presenting her show, we really wanted to focus on her as one of the leading painters of her generation. The exhibition was fully formed, selected, before the Whitney Biennial opened. When the Whitney Biennial opened and the debates around open casket unfolded very publicly, we began a lot of conversations, both internally as well as with people in our communities. And we continue those conversations.
Can
those
I just
are
jump in
artists.
Here? And yep. I'm sorry to interrupt, and I don't mean to be rude. I'm just conscientious of the
sure.
time, and I just want to get straight to the heart okay. of the matter here, because what I hear Barbara Lewis saying is that the ICA presented a sort of tone-deaf approach to the history of racism here in Boston, okay. and that's part of the reason why they had great concerns about this exhibition.
Let me answer that, yeah. and let me answer Dr. Lewis. We have consulted a wide variety of artists and people in our community, artists that we exhibit who have been in our program, who are from very diverse backgrounds and various viewpoints, educators, people who teach here in Boston, both at the college level as well as high school level, and community.
May I ask you to name some of them?
Well,
Steve Locke.
Yes, a colleague here. And many of those okay. were very private conversations. But we asked those individuals and continue to ask them, what programs do you want to hear at the ICA? What questions do you have? What should we be doing? What is our responsibility, not just to Dana as an artist, but to this topic, race, representation, cultural appropriation and our responsibility as an institution. And in response to that, we have a variety of robust programs that we will be presenting in the fall, which we spoke about with the group when we met with them a week and a half ago. We're in a partnership with the Hutchins Center for
Africa. Why wait until the fall, though? I mean,
I have to jump in here. This notion that somehow the ICA has all of a sudden been ignoring black people. There is a show right now, an excellent show up right now by Nari Ward. Nobody has called me to ask me about Nari Ward show. But for some reason, people have called me to talk about a painting by a white woman that's not even in this show. And let me say something about Emmett Till as a black man, okay? Emmett Till is dead. Nobody can hurt him anymore. No white woman with a paintbrush can hurt Emmett Till. No white woman with a paintbrush can undo what maybe Till did. That's what real power is, okay? So this notion that Dana has somehow... And I don't know Dana Schutz, and she doesn't need me to defend her because she's a grown woman. She can defend herself. She released a statement about her painting, and apparently that statement wasn't good enough for people because they want to impute some sort of horrible motive to her. If white people do not take responsibility for what they have done to black people, we are lost. That painting is a white woman sitting in front of a canvas negotiating what a white woman did to a black child. Emmett Till is dead because of the word of a white woman. It's wholly appropriate for a white woman to take that on as subject matter.
Barbara,
has anyone said anything during this conversation about a white woman not having a right to paint a canvas?
That is part of the context of the conversation, Barbara, and that's part of what is outlined in the letter. This whole, the lead into the show was Meghna saying, can a white artist image black pain? Of course they can. There's no such thing as black pain. There's just pain.
And Director Lewis, I take your point that you may not agree with every last note, that word that was written in the letter, but the letter does include a passage such as, the ICA should acknowledge publicly and in the text of the exhibition that a white femme artist tampered with the intention of a grieving black mother to humanely show in undeniable detail the brutality endured by her 14-year-old child. I mean, so...
Well, let me throw something which I think is explosive into the conversation. Let's say that a black male had painted the death face of Anne Frank grimacing on the floor of a concentration camp, grimacing in death on that floor. Would we be having this conversation and say that it's perfectly fine for a black male to paint such an image because Anne Frank is already dead?
Well, what's your answer to that question, Barbara Lewis?
My answer to that question is it's not so much about the painter himself or herself. It's about public opinion.
No.
And public reaction.
No. Artists don't really think about public reaction.
So every artist is exactly the same, and no artist thinks about public reaction?
I'm saying that there's a notion since art stopped being for kings and popes and started being the...
For people?
I beg your pardon?
For people?
Yeah. That's,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That people have their own concerns for making their work. The concerns for people making their artwork aren't subject for discussion.
What's shown in a museum, what's shown on the walls, what's given credence and credibility as iconic.
I don't think anybody's saying that can't happen. What I am saying is these calls for paintings to be destroyed, for artists
minute,
to be punished for things that they've made.
As I said before, I have not asked for any painting to be destroyed. I have not asked for a painting for the show to be closed.
Okay.
So if you're talking to me and I'm here on this radio show, then let's not bring in issues that others have sanctioned, but I have not.
Okay. So I was told that we were going to talk about this controversy in this letter that had been sent to the ICA. So if we're not going to talk about that, let me offer something else.
Okay, so let me just jump in here. And again, to reiterate, Barbara Lewis, as you have said, you are one of the signatories of the letter, but I do hear you say that you don't agree with everything that was written in the letter. And we have a link to it, by the way, at radioboston.org. And I want to reiterate that I appreciate everybody being here. But Ava Raspini, let me turn back to you something, because we were talking, we heard Barbara and Stephen engage about this question about artists' intent. But there is the question about an institution's intent and an institution's role here, because I do think one of the other major concerns that has been raised both in the letter and by Director Lewis is this idea that institutions have a cultural responsibility in the communities that they are in. And, you know, whom they choose to exhibit is part of that, and why. So what does the ICA see as its responsibility in this situation?
Absolutely. We take our institutional responsibility very seriously. And it's something we talked about in the meeting last week with the activists and artists that I met with for over 3 hours. And it may not be apparent to our larger publics, but every show that we organize, there's a lot of rigor and thought and collaboration and partnership that goes into that. We consult many people in our communities, our peers, our colleagues, other artists. I don't like to work in a vacuum. And so the result of every exhibition project comes from collaboration and partnership and discussion. And that's our institutional responsibility. I do believe that an artist has the right to choose to paint, sculpt, or present whatever subject that resonates for them. But it's the institution's responsibility to put into context the historical, social, and political resonance of that chosen subject. And that's what we're doing with the Dana Schutz exhibition. We're showing the broader context of her work. You will see 17 paintings, 4 drawings, the last 10 years of production. And Dr. Lewis, I invite you to come in and walk through the show with me. It would be my delight to do that with you. But also, we're providing a context for conversations about race and representation through exhibitions that we have on view now, as Steve mentioned, Neri Ward, whose work is about the immigrant experience, Steve McQueen, a work that's on view currently at the museum that's all about the death of a young man that he met in Granada. And next year, we're presenting an exhibition, Black Radical Feminism, 1965 to 1985, that's looking at how artists used political action in their work. So these are just some of the voices among many others that we're presenting at the ICA to engage our various publics, and we take that responsibility very seriously.
Barbara Lewis, please respond.
I appreciate that the ICA is doing all of this. I think it's wonderful. But I also remain concerned about the context of death that exudes from at least 2 of the paintings of Dana Schutz that involve black males and eviscerated, castrated black males. And I do this in the context of what's happening politically in this country and also in this city. We stand here in a Boston that has recently declared through its mayor that it is a city very concerned about and eager to correct the racial difficulties and sins of its past, as well as its omissions of the present. Mm. And to me, that is the public context that matters, and that is a public context that doesn't seem to have been fully, partially taken into context.
If I may, my question to you, Dr. Lewis, would be, how does muting an artist, canceling a show, further
Wait a minute,
that dialogue?
Can we keep going back to that? I'm not asking anybody to cancel a show. I'm asking for a wider discussion. You talked earlier about rigor and thought, collaboration and partnership. I feel that there may be a few more individuals and groups that could be brought into that collaboration and partnership. For example, the work of Dr. Atiyah Martin around racial equity and resilience. I think that the ICA offers the public a wonderful opportunity to have a discussion on those kinds of issues here in Boston.
Stephen Locke, you want to jump in here?
There's a way in which this whole conversation is about what the ICA hasn't done or what the ICA isn't doing. And I think that there is a lack of awareness about the amount of programming and the amount of work that the ICA actually does do. I think it's a little unfair also to say that it's a museum's job to respond to public opinion in terms of the racial climate, as if museums don't do that already. I think that there's a way in which if you go to the ICA right now and you see the work that's up, there's a very interesting conversation happening. And it's not just this one show. There's also Black and White, Black and Brown People, White Problems, a show that's curated by Camilo Alvarez that's up at Samson right now. There's lots of people in the art world addressing these issues. I know that Dr. Lewis says that she doesn't want the show to be closed and she's not against, she's not for destroying a painting. But this whole conversation now has sucked all the air out of the room about the work of Dana Schutz as an artist, the work of Nari Ward, the work of Kevin Jerome Everson, the work of Colleen Smith, the work of Deanna Lawson, all sorts of artists.
I think you're overstating your case.
Well, you're welcome to think that. We just happen to disagree. We disagree, Dr. Lewis. We disagree.
Well, you know, if I always dream of reaching a kind of consensus in these conversations, but sometimes it's not possible. But that means the conversation must continue, and unfortunately we can't do that today. So I just want to say, Barbara Lewis, director of the William Moore Trotter Institute at UMass Boston, thank you, and Ava Raspini, chief curator at the ICA, and Stephen Locke, professor at the Mass College of Art and Design, thank you all. We will continue this conversation on another day. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.